Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Honestly, how hard can it be? You take a budget, you make some cuts. Boom! There's your sequestration. How they're going to do it at the Pentagon, coming up on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 22nd of February. Good as always to have you with us. First of all, I wasn't kidding yesterday when I said we really need to come up with a better word than sequestration. Second of all, that being the case, we're just going to call it budget cuts until somebody gets inspired. And third of all, 1 week, people, that's how long we've got until the budget cuts start happening. Ashton Carter is the Deputy Secretary of Defense. He's the guy whose job it is to run the Pentagon day to day and so to find the $46 billion that the military's got to cut between now and the end of the fiscal year at the end of September. Mr. Secretary, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
You were at the White House earlier today, sir, talking about sequestration, I imagine, and a bunch of other things. What kind of odds would you give me on whether this thing's going to happen or not?
Well, the president just said he doesn't rule anything out and is still hopeful. We here in the Department of Defense, unfortunately, are getting ready to execute sequester, which is just one, actually, of the budget catastrophes that are upon us.
Okay, so I imagine you have a manual that tells you how you're going to do what you have to do to find these cuts.
There is no manual. I don't think anybody's ever done anything this way, and for a very good reason, which is it's a really dumb way to do things. We've cut our budget before. We did last year, but we didn't do it the sequester way. We had a chance to do it strategically and to ask the right question, which is what does the country need?
I want to make sure I understand you here, Mr. Secretary. You are calling the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States, your boss a couple of steps removed, stupid.
Well, the mechanism is stupid. I don't want to call – I certainly don't want to call my boss stupid or anybody in Congress. It's not that.
All right. So how do you do it then? I mean, how do you sit down and say you lose 10%, you lose 8.5%, you lose 14,000 people, and you lose an aircraft carrier?
Let's take the accounts that fund training. In the case of the Army, for example, it's halfway through the year and the Army has to make up a 30% cut. It means that you have to trim back training now to only that which is essential to prepare the troops to go to Afghanistan. All the rest of the Army, you can't train because you don't have any money.
You know how you hear in business news stories all the time, and we've been hearing this for a couple of years now, how businesses and corporations hate uncertainty, right? They don't know what to do. Explain to me how that affects you. You know, the 19-year-old seaman waiting to deploy on the Lincoln who really can't, or the 37-year-old Army lieutenant colonel. I mean, how does that play out?
Well, it certainly plays out on morale. It plays out on their family. And very worryingly to me, it will inevitably play out on their willingness to stay in.
So have you been having conversations, Mr. Secretary, with heads of defense contractors who say, listen,
absolutely.
Ashton, you are out of your mind if you think we're going to keep doing business with you?
Yeah, fortunately, none of them have gone that far yet, and I hope they don't. But I'll tell you, what you just said will apply to some of them, not the big contractors who are the prime contractors to us, but subcontractors who don't have the financial resources to live through this kind of turmoil in their marketplace.
You're an unreliable customer.
Exactly.
On the theory that this has already done some damage to preparedness and morale and readiness, how long will it take, once Congress and the president get their act together, for you to undo the damage and get back to where you need to be?
Oh, we would change course immediately if we were relieved of sequestration. However, some of the things that we will be forced to do will have lasting consequences. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. If you turn off a program in industry, it may be that by the time you're ready to turn it back on, that business has failed. Or at a minimum, you've driven up the cost structure and you're going to pay more for that weapon system. So it's going to create lasting damage. And finally, Kai, you have to remember the whole world is watching this.
You betcha.
Our friends are watching it, our allies are watching it, and our enemies are watching it as well. And that, too, causes lasting reputational embarrassment, the reputation that this country knows what it's about and can stick with its international commitments.
Ashton Carter is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the number two guy in that department. He's trying to find $46 billion between now and the end of the fiscal year. Mr. Carter, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
Good day, lousy week on Wall Street. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Oscar Pistorius made bail today. He was arrested a week ago for the shooting death of his girlfriend. And you've probably heard about this story, right? In fact, you've probably heard a lot about this story because the media frenzy is in full swing, dredging up memories on the cable news circuit of the glory days of the OJ trial, which has to be good for the business of media. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The Oscar Pistorius story is almost tailor-made for the media, says entertainment analyst Robert Galinsky.
Here comes a real-life hero, this guy who's overcome being a double amputee, and if something major like this happens, it's a bonanza for the media.
News networks have gotten very skilled at making stories like these into mega news events, says Aram Sinreich, a media professor at Rutgers University.
They all have this kind of car crash quality to them, like you don't want to look, but you can't turn away.
And that means big ratings and ad dollars, says Sinreich.
A great recent example of this was CNN actually saw a 74% ratings boost during their several-day coverage of the stranded Carnival cruise ship.
Those ratings bumps have now been baked into the business model of 24-hour cable news, says Robert Thompson, a professor of popular culture at Syracuse University. Thompson says networks learned how to make a news event into a media blitz during another famous athlete's murder trial.
Well, OJ, I think many people point to as the real moment when we reach the maturity of this kind of coverage. These kinds of stories, in effect, become cottage industries.
OJ's trial meant months of gavel-to-gavel coverage. Lawyers and witnesses became mini-celebrities and news stories themselves. Thompson says you just can't get that kind of mileage out of the Greek debt crisis or the dreaded sequester. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
She said that word. I guess she didn't get the memo. I don't know. All right. You know how there's been this vibe lately that Google's becoming the new Apple? And if you hadn't heard, well, first of all, I'm sorry. But second of all, there is a lot of that talk going around. And wouldn't you know it, Google's got a new laptop out. It's called the Pixel. It's got a super high definition touchscreen, just like a certain tablet you might have heard of. Hence, Google as the new Apple in more ways than one. Marketplace's Queen of Cam reports.
Apple has them, and so does Microsoft. And the word is Google's going to have them soon, too. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst with the Altimeter Group.
The rumors started circulating around a week ago about a Google store, which I think is a terrific idea for Google.
The rumor stirred up yesterday with the unveiling of Pixel, which will cost about $1,300. Pixel is part of Google's Chromebook line of computers, which are cloud-based. That means your spreadsheets won't be on your hard drive, but will live online, much like your email. Kirti Kalyanam is a professor at the Retail Management Institute at Santa Clara University. He says the stores would be the perfect place for Google to sell its infamous Google Glass, a wearable computer that sits on your face like eyeglasses.
Google is pushing the boundaries of what cannot be done. And as they push the boundaries, they come up with products that are very hard for people to envision or understand.
Kalyanam says products like Google Glass will probably need dedicated salespeople and a sophisticated display, something big box retailers like Best Buy can't provide. Trip Chowdhury is an analyst at Equity Research, and he says Google might be late to the store trend, and it risks looking like an Apple wannabe, much like the Microsoft stores.
The days of opening store is over. Microsoft is losing because there is nothing much that they're offering.
Chowdhury says it's not just about having products, but getting people to buy them. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Let us pause now for a moment of Zen, a chance to reflect on the week we just had, all in 5 minutes of live radio. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher with us from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC as well. Hey, guys.
Hey, hi, Kai.
All right. That was nice. You did that together. That was good. Did you practice that? All right. So listen, Lee, let's pick up with what the defense secretary was talking about, the budget cuts and all of that. You know, there's a lot of headwinds now, I think is what economists say about the economy, right? You had taxes going up. You have higher gas prices, a lot of money coming out of people's pockets. Government's not going to be spending money. Are you worried about the economy in the next, I don't know, 6 months?
You know, the fundamentals of the economy actually look pretty good if you look at...
You sound like a politician.
Well, they would look good if it weren't for the politicians. Maybe I should say that. You know, we were really kind of gaining a lot of momentum on this recovery. Certainly, if you look at the stock market, that's a completely different story. But, you know, these budget cuts, I'll call them under your direction, are not going to be good on top of, you know, the tax increase, the payroll tax increase has already kind of had an impact. We saw Walmart come out and kind of credit that today as one negative impact in its earnings. So this stuff is starting to chip away, and I think the just uncertainty, which I hate to use that word, but when consumers don't know what else is going to be cut, people that work in the government, are their jobs going to be lost, that's going to impact everything.
John Carney, give me your gut. What do you say, man?
Everything's going to be fine.
The budget, the actual budget cuts before we did it
only amount to around $44 billion. It's not a lot of money.
No, hold on a minute. Hold on. It's 85 total, half of which goes civilian, 44, and half of which goes to the Pentagon. 46,
right. Well, those are the authorizations, not the outlays. So the actual money that the government spends into the economy is only about half of that.
Okay.
And so we can easily take it. Even at the full number of 85, we could take that. Our economy is strong enough right now that it turns out, you know, maybe this whole, I won't use the words,
I'll call it
March Madness isn't such a bad idea.
Oh, March Madness. Oh, I love that one. That one's good. All right, wait, John, I want to stay with you for a minute because you, you always are an island of contrariness, but everybody's running around like it's the end of the bleeping world, man. Have you not been paying attention?
I think they paid it, you know, everybody watched, you know, the fiscal cliff and, you know, all of these things that were happening. And so we're used to having panics about government budget fights. I don't think this is, and I myself, you know, was very worried about what would have happened if we went off the fiscal cliff. This is not that. This is a minor reduction in government spending that, you know, that a company like Apple could make up just by increasing its dividend a lot. It's not that much money in terms of the whole economy.
Apple, if it wanted to, could solve this whole thing. Lee, I don't know. Is John, I have a tough time processing what John is saying, actually.
Well, look, I mean, John is right in that this would not have the impact that going over the fiscal cliff would have had.
Okay, wait, but stop. Explain why.
Because the impact of the entire middle class seeing their tax rates go up would have had a much bigger impact.
Okay.
It's basic, you know, it's arithmetic. It's the same reason why we need a strong middle class in general, which is another story.
Like, and again, you sound like a politician. I'm just saying.
Don't worry.
All right.
I'm keeping my day job. It's still significant. I mean, it's not as significant, but it's still a big deal. And I think, you know, combined with just, you know, I think overall the uncertainty is not great.
To be honest, I think that the rise in the payroll tax is actually more significant than this minor cut in government spending. I think it was a mistake to let FICA come back on. And we're already seeing that in the earnings reports of companies like Walmart and McDonald's.
FICA being that tax, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Remember that for a lot of people, their payroll taxes went from nothing because if you earn more than $113,000, you max out. So at the end of the year, when the new year came around, they saw their paychecks drop by 6%. It's like everybody got a demotion. And that's actually going to hurt the economy far more than a minor reduction in the budget deficit.
All right. So once we get past all this stuff about March Madness, John, what are you actually worried about in the economy, if anything?
I think the big risk right now is that the Fed is undershooting its inflation targets. The Cleveland Fed just announced yesterday what the 10-year inflation outlook of the public is, and it's 1.5%. That's too low. The Fed needs it to be higher. They've publicly declared they want 2% inflation.
Did you
we don't have that.
Did you hear the show yesterday? We declared inflation dead.
Exactly. And this is a problem. It means that the Fed policy is not working. And that's my biggest fear, is that the Fed and I don't see any sign that they're really paying attention to this, that they have lost their credibility at being able to control inflation, you know, on the downside. Right. Everybody was worried. How many times have we all heard, inflation's going to go out of control? Not happening.
All right, Lee, 15 seconds. What are you really worried about?
I'm most worried about growth. You know, our economy is supposed to grow at maybe 2% this year. It would be a completely different story. We would all be talking about much different things if that number were going to be 3. And it's just, that's the biggest, you know, question out there, I think. And that would really have an impact on everything.
All right. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. We'll see you. Coming up, when banks just walk away.
I probably run across 2 or 3 a week that the name is still in the old owner, but we know that it's the bankruptcy file. They just haven't closed on it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 119 points today. 0.8% sits at exactly 14,000 points. What do you think the odds are of that? Come on. The Nasdaq popped up 30 points, 1%, ends at 3161. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, 0.9%, finished at 1550. A lot of symmetry in these numbers today. For the week, though, the Dow gained just 0.1%. The S&P 500 took off 0.3%. The Nasdaq deleted almost a full percent. Hewlett-Packard shot up 12% today. HP profits were strong despite the shrinking market for personal computers. Texas Instruments lassoed a 5% gain. Abercrombie & Fitch unraveled 4% today. Revenue was up, but not as much as expected. Bond prices rose despite that gain in stocks. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 1.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. John Kerry will be on his first trip as Secretary of State. It's an 11-day tour of Europe and the Middle East. Clothing retailer Wet Seal shortens its ticker symbol from WTSLA to WTSL. And February is Return Shopping Carts to the Supermarket Month. Wrangle those runaway baskets back to the corral. Only a few more days to take advantage of this opportunity to be extra good. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Maybe the scariest thing that came out of that Chinese hacking report earlier this week was the idea that they could, if they wanted to, have their way with some of our infrastructure, water systems, power grids, that kind of thing. And, you know, blackouts, we can deal with. Hacking, maybe not. So we sent Marketplace's David Weinberg off to figure out exactly how vulnerable our grid might be.
The National Research Council recently issued a report, Terrorism and the Electric Power Delivery System. It found the system to be highly vulnerable for two reasons.
First of all, it's physically vulnerable.
Granger Morgan is one of the authors of the report. He says that large, high-voltage transformers are particularly vulnerable, and many of these transformers are at facilities in wide open spaces.
So a small number of people who knew what they were doing could do a very large and very disruptive damage to the system.
Repairing broken transformers could leave large numbers of people without power for weeks or even months. Now, for the second reason the system is highly vulnerable, cyber attacks.
All the hype is about cyber attack. But as I said before, physical attack can take the system down for weeks or months, and it's almost impossible to see how you do that with cyber attack.
Either way, the solution to these vulnerabilities is to break up the system into smaller microgrids.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge.
Enter the bureaucracy.
The electric utility industry already has a self-regulatory body. It's called the North American Electric Reliability Council, NERC.
Richard Caperton is an energy expert at the Center for American Progress. In addition to NERC, there's also federal FERC, and then there are the state governments.
Right. A lot of the nuts and bolts of the equipment and making sure that equipment is secure will be decided at the state level.
90% of the U.S. power grid is privately owned. That means the government will have to coordinate with regulators and utilities to make the necessary changes. In other words, it's not a quick fix. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Come Tuesday next, President Obama is going to be down in Hampton Roads, Virginia, the Newport News shipyard, to be precise, for a speech about about March Madness. The USS Abraham Lincoln will figure prominently in the president's remarks. A big servicing contract for the aircraft carrier has been delayed because of March Madness. And the Lincoln, you might recall, is the same ship on which President Bush delivered his famous Mission Accomplished speech. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports big ships can be big political marketing tools.
I mean, as a culture, we're kind of a little bit obsessed with big Navy ships. Cher sang on one. If I could turn back time. We play basketball games on them now.
Anchors away, baby!
But you know who's the most obsessed? Is politicians. President Bush.
The United States and our allies have prevailed.
President Obama.
One of the greatest privileges of this job, and one of the greatest responsibilities of this job, is to serve as your commander-in-chief.
Going to aircraft carriers goes back to Reagan, perhaps earlier, but the last three presidents have all turned to aircraft carriers as props.
David Gergen is a longtime political advisor and professor at Harvard. He says presidents like big boats because
they're just awesome.
They are. They're like the Empire State Building on its side.
Aircraft carriers are perhaps the foremost symbol of American power and strength. You wrap yourself in the flag and in the title of commander-in-chief.
In terms of marketing value, it's priceless, but it doesn't have to cost all that much. According to the Navy, if they approve you, the Navy won't charge you anything to use its ships in a movie or a speech, except what it costs to get your equipment on board. When you're talking aircraft carriers, though, it's easy to go too far, says Gergen.
There's always a danger of grandiosity.
Like when George Bush landed on one with a Mission Accomplished banner. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There was a thing that happened a lot during the depths of the housing bust. Homeowners who found themselves underwater on their loans, owing more on a mortgage than what the house was worth, were just walking away, letting the banks have the place. Problem is that sometimes the very process of foreclosure cost more than the property was worth. So now banks are just walking away. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge has this story from the Wealth and Poverty Desk.
So why would a bank just walk away from a foreclosure? It usually happens in working-class neighborhoods with old housing stock that's not worth a lot of money. Because the banks actually lose money on the foreclosure, it's cheaper to do nothing. That was the situation at 212 East Gear Street in Durham. The walk-away property sat right next door to Frank Burgess.
There were tenants here, but they weren't the nicest. And they were the cleanest because they would put the baby Pampers, they'd toss them right over the railing, they'd toss them out the back door on our side of the property, of course.
Burgess is a city bus driver. It took him and his wife a while to settle on their dream home on East Gear. But that was soon followed by bad neighbors and bad loitering.
All of the drug activity, prostitution, the alcohol. It was daunting, but me and my wife, we just felt like it's our home. We stand in.
Records show the East Gear property was purchased 7 years ago with financing from Countrywide Mortgage Corporation. A couple of years later, the owner filed for bankruptcy and stopped making payments. The property soon became Bank of America's responsibility.
We've made every effort to communicate with each of the banks. It's taken quite a bit of work.
Peter Skillern runs a nonprofit called Reinvestment Partners that just happens to be one block from the problem house on East Gear Street. Skillern says his organization was finally able to buy the house a few weeks ago. It cost $27,000 at a foreclosure sale. That's about a third of what the old owner paid in 2006.
We spoke to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the North Carolina Attorney General's office. We filed a local complaint at the court. We're very pleased that Bank of America finally did respond, and we have been able to resolve the issue, but it was an example of the extraordinary efforts it takes to resolve these problems.
East Gear is now a success story, but the latest General Accounting Office report says there are 38,000 bank walkaways across the U.S. People on the ground say that estimate is on the low side. Rick Hester sees this firsthand. He's the housing code administrator for the city of Durham.
I do know that I probably run across two or three a week, that the name is still in the old owner, but we know that it's the bankruptcy has been filed, they just haven't closed on it.
Hester wants to get these houses in the hands of people who will fix them up and get them back on the tax rolls. He says it's about finding good neighbors for hardworking people like Frank Burgess.
I love the house. I was born and raised in Durham. I have a lot of family here, and I love this place. This is home.
And he doesn't plan on going anywhere soon. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the storied New York Police Department becomes a division of Apple Incorporated. The New York Daily News reports today that the NYPD is setting up a new team to track, just to track, iPhone and iPad thefts. A couple of months ago, Mayor Michael Bloomberg blamed the rise in overall crime in the city on Apple products that were subjected to the five-finger discount. And I will close with just this. What my mother used to say to me when I went into the city when I was a kid, keep an eye on your stuff, people. Come on. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Today, the Dow gained 119 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ popped up 30 points. That is 1%. The S&P 500, it rose 13 points, 0.9%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, High Rollers Caveat Emptor.
Basically, the casinos are on the honor system to give you a fair game.
What could possibly go wrong? All right, we'll see you Monday. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.